Welcome to The B-Sides, a podcast for progressives who love pop music. We're your hosts. I'm Hannah.
I'm Mimi.
And I'm Becky. Tune in for new episodes every other Wednesday to hear our conversations on pop's place in our world.
And the music you should put in your ears to fuel your reckoning with the trash fires all around us. Thanks for tuning in. Here we go.
Welcome to The B-Sides.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The B-Sides. We are a podcast for people who love Carly Rae Jepsen and want to see the fall of capitalism in our time. And if that's you, we're so glad you're here. Today, we're going to talk about inflection points in artists' careers. Those moments when an artist just tried something new and things were never the same. We'll remind ourselves that nothing is inevitable. We're a part of history, et cetera, and we'll hone our ability to analyze choices that artists make or ways that they respond to choices that were outside of their control. For example, choices that George Bush made. This is just a preview. So subscribe if you haven't already. We come out every other Wednesday, so subscribing makes it way easier to keep up, and open up the description of this episode to find other ways to join this internet home. And I want to say this is especially a relevant request because actually we won't be coming out every other Wednesday for much longer. We only have a few more episodes left in the season, as Becky was telling us in the last episode. And then the B-Sides podcast is like low-key, maybe, probably, but who knows, coming to an end, which is wild. We've had an iconic 4 years, if we do say so ourselves. We hope to still use this feed every once in a while. Who knows what the future has in store, but for, you know, no plans right now for a season 4. And we'll miss you all on this feed. We hope you'll miss us in your ears.
Yeah, for sure. So you should definitely join us on the internet. The link to join our Discord is in the show notes. You can also join us on Instagram. We're very active there. And we also have a TikTok, Twitter, and a Facebook, which are all linked in the show notes. Our Discord especially isn't going anywhere. So if you think you'll find yourself missing pop music analysis, the Discord will be the place to be. So basically, we're not sure about a next season, but the community will live on no matter what.
There'll be no Discord in the Discord.
Nothing discordant. Yeah, absolutely. I think that we couldn't stop the Discord if we tried. You know what I'm saying? Like, that train has left the building. Is that the phrase? The train has left the station.
I would like to see you try, though.
Yeah, we should try as a social experiment.
Okay.
Just kidding, Discord participants. We're not going anywhere. Okay, yeah. So thanks for your love and thanks for joining us on the internet. And why don't we get into today's episode, shall we?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if we're going to have a whole episode about inflection points, we probably should define for ourselves what is an inflection point as it relates to music. And Mimi, this episode idea, I believe, was yours. So I think that you are very well placed to define inflection point for us all.
Yeah, well, I think inflection points are an undercurrent of a lot of our episodes and show up in life all the time. I would say an inflection point is a moment of big possibility where something could have gone multiple ways and something did go in a different direction. Often drastically. This is one of the things that drew me to study history and to work in K-12 education, knowing that nothing people do is truly inevitable, is a really powerful reframing. And it's also true. It goes against what we're usually taught and what seems obvious, but is not true, which is that history and our lives are just like a series of inevitable events, and that progress is a straight line, just generally going up for decades and decades, all sorts of things like that, which can make us complacent. And I'm talking about that with my like history educator hat on. But really, like, the course of history always involves choices. It occasionally involves radical breaks in the state of things. And all of that is true for us today too, because we're also a part of history. We're also ancestors to future generations. We're also building legacies and setting up the world for them. And not every moment we're going to talk about today is that deep on its own. But revisiting inflection points, these moments of big possibility that in retrospect often feel inevitable, like we can't imagine on the surface things a different way, that often feel inevitable, but we're not, can teach us a lot about culture, can reveal a lot about the different forces at work, and can help us recognize what choices and possibilities are available to us in society today. Exploring counterfactuals, aka examining what did not happen in pop culture, pop music, helps us understand it all better. And it's also just very, it's a very interesting and often fun exercise, I do feel.
I totally agree. And I think that sometimes it helps to paint a picture of what something is, like, you know, of what a definition is by sharing a counterexample. So in addition to the definition of what an inflection point is, an example of what it's not is an artist like Meghan Trainor, which also, Mimi, was your idea to talk about because it's so funny. Basically, like, Meghan Trainor has not had any inflection points in her career, which is honestly a feat. And in some ways, like, we're really proud of her. Like, good job, Meghan. Way to just be the same.
Just she is mother.
What'd you say? Mother.
Well, that's what's so, like, funny, kind of, is that she clearly had a lot of things that happened in her life and in her personal, she's a mother now, like Becky said, but at the same time, she's been in 2014 this whole time. You know what I mean? Like, both and. So, yeah, I think that she's just an interesting example because she seems actually trapped in 2014 in a way that she seems okay with, but I'm a little concerned for her.
No. Yeah, it's like her career hasn't really, like, moved because she hasn't really taken any risks, but she's just, like, a constant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm sure for her, she feels she's taken risks. I'm sure. But from the outside, yeah, there hasn't been, like, a moment of, I mean, I think another way to think about an inflection point is a moment where there's, a before and an after. And I can't figure out a moment besides All About That Bass being her moment, her first, you know, getting on the scene, that there was, like, a before and after for Meghan Trainor.
Right. Yeah. That's beautiful in a way.
No one's going to be like, you know, that song Me Too, that was that there was nothing. It was never the same after that, or her it song No or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
All those written. Everything's always songs. The same after.
Yeah. Exactly. It's almost soothing.
Yeah. I love that for her. Mm-hmm. Great. All right, let's get into it.
Okay, so we have three categories today and then a catch-all category at the end, a lightning round, if you will. Will you?
You will.
In each category, we'll answer the questions, what happened, what was inevitable, what wasn't, and what does this tell us? So let's get started with category one, albums as inflection points. Albums are always a chance for reinvention, and artists frequently, if not always, use new album cycles as a chance to enter a quote-unquote new era, which, as we know, Taylor Swift, she loves her eras. Sometimes the albums themselves mark not only a serious shift from their previous work, but also from the person they feel they were perceived to be. And with that, there's simply no turning back, as we will learn from, I would argue, more of the era's queen than Miss Swift.
That's it. Okay, so we're going to look at one from this category, and the era's queen that Becky is referring to is Miley Cyrus. Miley Cyrus, whose new album just dropped, but we're taking it back to 2013 with her album Bangers. So we want to talk about Bangers as an inflection point, and then maybe we can think about what a counterfactual, I don't know, might have been for that, for this moment. So what happened? Miley's 2013 album Bangers brought us hits like We Can't Stop and Wrecking Ball and iconic B-sides like F You and Someone Else. I really love this album. It has really, really good songs on it. It was her fifth album. It was preceded by Meet Miley Cyrus, Breakout, the time of our lives, and Can't Be Tamed. Those were her first four albums. But in some ways, honestly, it feels like her first album. Like it's her first hit album. The goal of this era, at least as far as we could tell from the outside, was to cement a bad girl, I'm not a Disney kid look. But it was also her cultural appropriation era. She, maybe she's had a few of those, but this was definitely the biggest. She absolutely used blackness as a signifier for her deliberate fall from grace, her love of partying, her tougher edge. And to be clear, especially in 2013, black-led, black-forward music was incredibly commercially successful. So, you know, that helped her too. There were six features on this album. Five of them were black artists: Nelly, Big Sean, Future, Ludacris, and French Montana. Actually, the sixth was Britney Spears, but that's interesting. And now, of course, the problem with cultural appropriation will always be that Black people are humans, not props. And it's unethical at best and harmful at worst to use an entire population of marginalized humans to sell a brand or sell an album. And this era was complex because there's like so much going on here. It was so cringe, right? Like thinking about the We Can't Stop booty slaps, like in the music video where she's like slapping Black women's butts. I'm also thinking of like the Robin Thicke VMAs performance. It was so cringe. I don't know if there are other cringe moments from that era that we should highlight.
I think those were the big ones.
Oy, so bad. And
we watched that together.
At the VMAs.
Unfortunately, the VMAs performance. Yeah, that was tough.
Yeah. So it's very complex because those things were happening, but also like Bangers itself, in my opinion, and a lot of people agreed, is like a really good album. It's really good. So it's not all cringe. So that's what happened. So what was inevitable about this moment? In my opinion, it's totally inevitable that the Disney girl wants a bad girl rebrand in music and in aesthetics. That just like not a surprise there. What wasn't inevitable? A few things. One is that it does not feel inevitable to me that this album was so good. Meaning like, I don't know. I think it could have been random. I think it could have been bad. I think it could have been cringe. I don't know. And I think I really like a lot of the songs. I think Wrecking Ball is like a masterpiece. Like I love that song. And I don't think that was inevitable. Other thing not inevitable is that Miley Cyrus would look so good with a bleached pixie undercut. Like, who knew? Maybe that's my personal opinion, that I thought she looked good. So what does this tell us? Disney girls are going to rebel. That we know, that we've always known. But the specifics of this moment, I think, are pretty fascinating. Like, you know, how much she benefited from a proximity to Blackness is complicated. She never really did. She never really embarked on an era that so embraced Black artists and music again. There are Black artists featured on her 2019 album, or maybe it's an EP, I don't remember, called She Is Coming. And of course, you know, Black people invented rock and roll, so Plastic Hearts has that lineage to thank, maybe, but that's a little bit of a stretch. Ultimately, this was a short-lived rebellion era. It was meant to push her into contemporary relevance and then served as a perfect fall guy for her 2017 album called Younger Now, which was all about how that time in her life was excessive. In that album's rollout, so now we're talking about the after of this, she was like giving interviews condemning hip hop culture as misogynistic. And it's like, who asked you? Excuse you. Anyway, yeah, that was like a really frustrating moment to witness in real time. I remember putting out a B-Sides newsletter, like really frustrated about that, of like having it was so convenient for her to embrace Black music and then so convenient to her to distance herself from it. So anyway, Bangers was definitely the natural succession of 2010's Can't Be Tamed in terms of like being a bad girl, but it was bigger, it was better, and it was way more successful. And you know, was like really cemented her as an artist who was going to be around for a long time, even when she was done with the Disney machine behind her. And from then on, she proved that she was an artist who was going to be reborn with every album and era, which was not the case. Her first few albums were like pretty linear, pretty straightforward, and that she'd be a chameleon musically with whatever is in the ether. While also in some ways showing us like a fundamental core of her as an artist, which is pushing boundaries, embracing the uniqueness of her voice, being naked and having fun. And whatever genre she tackles, she will be doing those things. Mimi, Becky, curious your thoughts about this inflection point.
It's funny. I just looked up when the Miley Cyrus Salvia Bong hit was, thinking that it was close in line with Bangers, and it's not. It's like 3 years prior to Bangers, or yeah, like three-ish. And so I think obviously, like, as you say, the rebellion was like going to happen because she was a child star. And like more oftentimes than not, we see like a child star try to reinvent their image in a way that's like sexy and like not the little child that you've grown up knowing. But I do think she's more so of the different kind of eras than almost any artist. Because her voice sounds great in so many different sounds. And I love this new album. And she's kind of like back to her like pop, rockish roots. Like maybe she's like an era that's a circle.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting with her. I mean, and it's interesting talking about all of this and sort of like what was the push with all of these? What is sort of like the domino that's pushed that leads to a chain of events, you know?
Yeah.
Like if she weren't a child star, she would not have had a Bangers era, most likely.
Right.
Even if she were a star later on, like even if she was famous when she was 17, she also has a father who's famous and stuff. So that was not going to happen that way anyway. But yeah, I think she's so interesting because she is sort of like fluid in all of the things that she does and the way she approaches everything and is, like you said, a chameleon ready to change all the time. But her voice is so consistent and unmistakable and works in all of these different genres. So she's a very interesting person in that way. Like we talked last week about how Avril's voice is not it was not consistent and changed and a lot. And Miley, I don't feel that way at all, despite how many eras she tries on. But I do think, of course, as you said, this was a problematic era for all the reasons you said. And I know we've talked about this before, but I just like, whenever we talk about her, I think of how she says that she dies every night and wakes up. I just have never heard anyone else say that before. And so I just feel like that on a micro scale, like leads to all of these different inflection points, with Bangers being the biggest one for sure. And the biggest departure from anything that she did before or since then.
And I think in terms of like counterfactuals, there's like a version of this 2013 album that was like straight pop. And you know, you never know, but that's the fun thing about counterfactuals is you can make something up and no one can say that's wrong. I don't think it would have been, I don't think she would still be as famous as she is today if she had done a straight pop album, like through it for the rest, like if her next four albums were the same as her first four albums. I just don't see it. I don't know why she would stay on the charts. I don't know why people would stay interested in her. I think they would say that's a, you know, child star who's, you know, tried to make it and is over now.
Yeah. Unless it were like the best pop album we've ever heard, or if it was something inventive in a different way. But I think that's not, we're just talking about her being on the same path. I think you're right. It wouldn't have made a splash the same way.
Yeah. And the fact that she's still relevant today is like is something that's not inevitable. And we should be like aware of that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cool. Great. Thanks, okay. Miley.
Okay. And just moving on briefly to some honorable mentions for others in this similar category. We've obviously talked about Miss Swift. Her name has been brought up, but you could similarly to compare to Reputation, you know, I think even 1989 was like a break, an inflection point in the change in her going from country to pop. Beyoncé's self-titled, which we'll speak about briefly later. There's a clear before and after that album for Beyoncé's career, Solange, you know, and if you keep listening to our podcast in 2 weeks, we'll be doing a nice comparison between Beyoncé and Solange. Anyway, her album, Seat at the Table, and Ariana Grande's infamous Thank You Next. And we have Pete Davidson to thank for that.
Mother? No.
Mother. Megan Trainor. Is that you? Calling.
That was my biological mother.
It wasn't Megan Trainor being not like, Megan Trainor. Knock, knock, I heard what you said, and I have an inflection point for you.
She's like, you're wrong. Because one time I pooped next to my husband and I talked about it. I told everybody that I do that. And that was an inflection point for me personally. Do you guys remember
and
that?
Is that
my
real?
Baby looks like a cartoon character. Yes.
Yeah.
She and her husband have two toilets and they talked about how they like to poop next to each other at the same time.
I really, really hate that. Yeah. That's cool.
I think it's fine to do. Just don't tell anybody about it. That's mm-hmm. for you.
Mm-hmm. That's for you. Yeah. You're violating other people's not wanting to know things like that when you like you're not violating your own privacy, but you're violating other people's right to not yeah, know things like
to
that.
To not know that.
Yeah.
Anyway, with that, let's take a quick break. Maybe I'll call my mom back. And when we come back, we'll dive into category two. I'm not going to call my mom back.
You should leave that in.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And we're back. Okay, so category two is, buckle up, global events. Okay. So sometimes an inflection point is a choice an artist makes. Sometimes it is that to some degree, but it's foisted upon them by the music industry. And sometimes it's foisted upon them by the world or world leaders making just like really, you know, terrible decisions as they do. So let's look at two examples for this one. Okay, so first we're going to talk about Mariah Carey. Here's what we're talking about. Here's what happened. We have a longer rundown, actually, and a context and analysis of this in two episodes, if you can believe it. Episode 37, What's in a Feud? And episode 38, Art Flop and Glitter Bomb. I'm still proud of that title.
Really good.
So there's more context there, but let's talk a little bit here. So basically, we're talking the summer of 2001. Mariah Carey is working on the rollouts of her album and film Glitter. She had just gone through a terrible divorce from music producer Tommy Mottola, and he set in motion a plan for J-Lo's team to steal the sample and rapper from Loverboy, Ja Rule, shortly before its release for I'm Real. And Mariah then had to scramble basically to pick up the pieces of that. In July of 2001, she makes a strange, very famous appearance on MTV's TRL. She had a great long-standing relationship with MTV, and she was there as a quote-unquote surprise guest, aka everyone in production knew she's going on the show because you can't just go on the show like that. There's a lot of security and whatnot. But they make it look like a surprise. So she comes out singing her new song, Lover Boy, like off camera. She gives the audience ice cream. The host at the time, the VJ, Carson Daly, basically like negs her, and she and like acts like he's really surprised and it's weird that she's there. She lets everyone know kind of offhand that she's exhausted and wants a day off. and people find the whole thing amusing, I think, on the show, which makes sense, but also like after and through the years after. And then she's hospitalized a week later for exhaustion. So Glitter's release dates, the soundtrack and the film, are both delayed, and the media has a field day reporting on her quote unquote breakdown. And there's a lot of negative publicity surrounding it, aka people villainizing her for being exhausted. Virgin Media, who she's working with on these projects, agree to postpone the film from August 31st to September 21st, and the album from August 21st to, yes, September 11th,
Whoops.
2001. Oops. So you could argue there are a lot of inflection points here. We're not going into like what could have changed about her mental health, or, you know, if she weren't with Tommy Mottola before, if J-Lo weren't, you know, all these different things. The inflection point we're talking about as a global event is 9/11. So oops, 9/11 happens. Now, there are very few times when you can blame a pop music or movie flop directly on 9/11, but we've got something here. There is an image of the Glitter poster in front of the collapsing Twin Towers. So no one cared about Glitter anymore after that, at least not as an actual, you know, artistic intervention. And Virgin Media quickly dropped Mariah in early 2002. In a post 9/11 world, immediately, US media and consumers doubled down on, you know, the time-honored tradition of building women up and tearing them down, especially Black women, starting with Mariah Carey and Glitter. The fear and anger of late summer, fall 2001, I think, incentivized the sort of escape into something less serious through bullying. Like, a lot of people had their minds made up about Mariah and Glitter, and the momentum was too much to shift the other way. Especially once 9/11 hit. So, you know, news of her music and movie flop, inextricable from her quote unquote breakdown, was on magazines, talk shows, radio, everywhere. So what was inevitable about this? Well, I have difficulty calling anything really inevitable, but I would say by that moment, the misogyny and racism that already pervaded the moment was probably inevitable. Like, you know, that over the summer, Mariah's admission that she was incredibly stressed and exhausted was completely unacceptable to most mainstream media and audiences at the time, especially when coming from a Black woman. But I do struggle to say that this sort of thing is always inevitable. You know, like, we can make new choices. We can radically break from the state of things. What feels more inevitable is simply actually that something a little lighter, that trends come back around. And Mariah was kind of bound to make a sort of glitzy, fun 80s nostalgia album, as she was trying to do with Glitter. What wasn't inevitable, I suppose, we could argue that delaying the album and movie was not inevitable, and then they would have come out weeks sooner. But I don't think that makes a huge difference on its own, given the already entrenched media narrative around Mariah and what the world would become soon after. 9/11 was inevitable from Mariah Carey's perspective and our perspectives as children, because she had no control over this attack or tragedy, unless there's something I don't know, but I'm pretty sure I know enough to know that. But 9/11 is not at all inevitable in that the writing was on the wall geopolitically, but George Bush was very much asleep at the wheel, and Bill Clinton before him, you know, made his own war hawk decisions in the 90s that led up to it. So there was a lot going on there. Without 9/11, if we're talking about counterfactuals, after which most cultural moments were subsumed into a very tense energy that left very little room for anything that was not strictly or subtextually patriotic or like non-controversial from that perspective, especially right after. As Glitter is supposed to debut, I think this album might have been much more appreciated, and maybe even the film more so on some level, even though it is a silly film, but it is a great album. I, you know, on the face of it, like, 2001 would have been a great time for 80s nostalgia, similar to how 2010 was kind of when 90s nostalgia came back around and so on. And now, like, you know, early 2000s nostalgia. So,
right.
I have said previously that it's as if everyone had already decided in the summer of 2001 that it was Mariah's time to unravel and they were excited to see it happen. But we'll never know for sure if that was meant to continue through the rest of the year or if Glitter would have actually, like, quote, redeemed her had it not been released against the literal backdrop of the Twin Towers collapsing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh my God.
So I guess I'll wrap by saying Mariah later said of the Glitter soundtrack and her experience, quote, I released it on September 11, 2001. The talk shows needed something to distract from 9/11. I became a punching bag. I was so successful that they tore me down because my album was at number two instead of number one. The media was laughing at me and attacked me, end quote. Now we see that now, so today we see the album as ahead of its time, even as a nostalgia piece in terms of its sound and guest features. In fact, we were just talking about Bangers and all the features on that. Something that was criticized about this album is how many features there were, which became such a popular
right
thing to do and seen as like art in a different way, that sort of collaboration. We, and I guess I'm talking about all of us societally, have also taken steps forward and steps back and then more steps forward and then back and forward in how we treat celebrities, especially Black women, giving them their due and their flowers and naming the systems that work against them. But the early 2000s set us back in so many ways and gave extra license to surveillance and policing, which is actually never good historically. So the what if 9/11 had never happened counterfactuals are almost too enormous to name for this and in all of our lives. But, you know, this narrative is one of them. And I think what this tells us is that luckily, first, this wasn't career ending for Mariah.
Yeah.
And that's definitely a testament to her work and talent. She bounced back in 2003, 2004, and is so loved today for her illustrious career. People even appreciate Glitter now. Just search hashtag justice for Glitter on Twitter and enjoy. But I do think it shows us that, one, nothing is guaranteed and we're all just hoping things work out. Like, we're hoping to follow through, but sometimes things get in the way and sometimes they obliterate our plans, as 9/11 did for so many people in so many countries and areas of life, truly. And two, I think that in a big crisis, fear, sadness, and anger are usually channeled into attacking the most vulnerable among us. I don't actually think that. I know that. I'm not saying that Mariah Carey was the most vulnerable among us regular people, but in the world of celebrities at the time, like, you could consider her in that kind of place. So, as Trey Greene wrote in Mike in September 2021, which is a great article that we can link, around the 20th anniversary of Glitter, quote, the rhetoric surrounding Glitter reflects the broader lack of respect and concern for the emotional and physical safety of Black women that continues to be an issue decades after its release, end quote. And that's my thesis. Any thoughts on this inflection point? Anything coming up for you?
Just a reminder of like how much we got it wrong, like what the narrative was about Glitter and about Mariah in general in this moment, and how like it's not just that we told the story badly, it's that we told the story like wrong, you know, the 9/11 of it all, the exhaustion of it all, the racism of it all. Like, I just think a lot of that was buried or ignored, and the story about Glitter is that it was a flop. And to put this all in context is like, it's not just important, it's just being truthful.
Mm-hmm. It also makes me happy to know that Mariah really rebounded from this inflection point too.
Yeah,
not all people do,
right?
Yeah, that's absolutely. I mean, as you were saying, like, that's a testament to her hard work and talent, and I think mm-hmm. that's not inevitable at all. Like, totally. I think that I was going to say weaker person. I don't mean that as a judgment, you know, but a person with less resiliency tools and less talent would have said like, you know, fuck this. I'm done. This is over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And someone who I guess didn't, well, I don't know. I was going to say someone who I guess didn't already have like a bunch of hits and an established career from the 90s. But those, I don't know that that's actually true. I think it's a testament to her. I agree. And yeah, we as a society got a lot of things wrong, including all of that, including the narrative around 9/11, which I think we're going to talk about a little more next.
Yeah, should we talk about 9/11 again? A little bit?
We always are a little
we
bit.
We always are. Okay, great. Let's go into our second of two examples of inflection points about global events in this category. So our second example is, of course, the chicks. So this is just a few years later. So we've set a great scene of the blind patriotism of these early aughts. So let's talk about what happened to the chicks in 2003. Once again, if you want a full rundown and context and analysis, this is also something we really like love to talk about. So if you like this topic, you'll really enjoy episode 21 of our podcast. It was called The Chicks Are All Punk. We've linked it in the description. So in 2003, lead chick, Natalie Maines, had just had a mostly fun and quickly over public feud with the singer Toby Keith about his song, Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue, in parentheses, the Angry American. She famously said, Mimi is shaking her head. That's the only appropriate reaction to a title like that. First of all, it's clunky. Second of all, it's stupid. Okay. Natalie famously said, it's ignorant and it makes country music sound ignorant. So Natalie and Toby, they have a little back and forth. It was controversial, but the chicks didn't suffer much from it at all. They even performed the anthem at the Super Bowl around this time. So like mostly it was okay. But then a month later, we have an inflection point. And I'm actually going to quote from episode 21 because Mimi wrote something that I just thought she really nailed it. And there's nothing else to say. So I'm going to quote it. They go on what's called the Top of the World Tour, which is the tour for their album Home. And on March 10th, 2003, in London, at their first show of the tour, Natalie Maines is introducing Travelin' Soldier, a cover that is taking off, and it's a song about a teenage girl waiting for a teenage army soldier to return from war and learns that he dies overseas. And this is happening while the U.S. is sending a lot of young people to Afghanistan to fight a fake war on terror and is about to invade Iraq in 10 days due to American imperialism masquerading as weapons of mass destruction. And she says to this European-ass crowd in London, although the UK was also a part of this joint invasion of Iraq, but that's different. Natalie says, just so you know, we're on the good side with y'all. We do not want this war, this violence, and we're ashamed that the president of the United States is from Texas. It's queen shit. It's a big deal. What ensued is the most pervasive, violent backlash to a pop music artist in decades. You can look up videos of organized protests in the US where one of the activities is just like ritualistically bulldozing their albums. Their songs were pulled from country radio. They received death threats. They were booed at awards shows. They were no longer selling out massive venues. In short, they became the most hated act in the country establishment when they were so adored, like not even a year prior. End quote of former us, aka Mimi in episode 21. So that's what happened. So what was inevitable about this moment? The war in Iraq was like definitely not inevitable. That's a different story, or is it? Maybe it's not a different story. But I will say that backlash to this kind of statement during this time, this post-glitter, post-9/11 time, backlash does feel inevitable, but what wasn't inevitable? Just how big of a backlash it was, I think. How big of a deal this was, and how they essentially like never fully recovered. They were truly on top of the world, as their tour name, album name suggested. And listen, they're definitely still a successful band today. The three of us saw their concert last year. It was like, you know, a pretty packed crowd. But, you know, they released an album in 2006. And then not another one until Gaslighter in 2020. It's a long time. What's also not inevitable, and what I think is really a sweet outcome of this, was just how good their musical rebuttal was, which was their iconic song, Not Ready to Make Nice. Like, oh my God, that song's amazing. We talk about it on this podcast all the time. So to kind of complicate the after of this inflection point, their 2006 album was called Taking the Long Way, and it actually won 5 Grammys, including Album of the Year, Record of the Year, and Song of the Year for Not Ready to Make Nice. So it wasn't like they were immediately canceled and never made music again. Like, no, they're still doing great a few years later, but it seems like this is a very complicated time. Country artists were distancing themselves from the Chicks and just embracing unquestioning patriotism. They have interesting quotes about this moment. There's an interview with the UK's Daily Telegraph where band member Emily says, "A lot of artists cashed in on being against what we said or what we stood for because that was promoting their career, which was a horrible thing to do. A lot of pandering started going on, and you'd see soldiers and the American flag in every video. It became a sickening display of ultra-patriotism," end quote. And then Natalie had a brilliant comment on patriotism in that same interview, saying, "The entire country may disagree with me, but I don't understand the necessity for patriotism." Yes, Natalie. Why do you have to be a patriot? About what? This land is our land? Why? You can like where you live and like your life, but as for loving the whole country, I don't see why people care about patriotism," end quote. I love this for her. I love that she's just like still like, you know.
That's an amazing quote. I'm obsessed. Yeah.
It's so real. It's so true. And it shows that she wasn't, you know, that's another thing. Like, what's not inevitable is that they didn't get completely spooked, right? Like, we saw their, you know, at the tour we went to last year, they were speaking out about world leaders. Like, they still feel very political. It's like a part of their brand now. I wonder if that was kind of, again, like foisted on them, but they kind of like made the most of it.
Should we paint a really quick picture of the green screens?
Yes, please do.
Okay. During one of their songs, they had green screens of, it was like an ocean with a sea monster, and then Putin was there floating along, and then the sea monster like grabbed him and ate him or something like that. And then there were a few, the conservative Supreme Court, the conservative wing, which is 6 people of the Supreme Court, floating along on like a raft. And then that went up in flames. So they did a little bit of that, which feels like a continuation of this.
It was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
What a moment. Yeah. So they definitely like this is who they are. This is their opinion. And I think that they got pushed into holding it even more strongly, which is interesting. Yeah. And the other thing to say about this time for them was that the tour for this album, even though it was Grammy winning and all those things, it did not do well. And in fact, they even needed to cancel some shows due to poor sales. So after that, they did a few things for sure, but they were mostly on hiatus until 2020. So what does this tell us? You know, we talk about this post 9/11 time. Mimi has coined the phrase the cultural void, for, you know, all the reasons that that name implies. And what this tells us is that the cultural void wasn't just a void meaning an emptiness, but a void meaning that it sucked everything good into it and turned everything around it dark and bad. And we hate that. And it also means that cancel culture only ever really has consequences for people who threaten the power structure. This had a huge chilling effect on artists. Artists didn't want to be like the Dixie Chicks. Like, that was like a fear that artists, even Taylor Swift, have like really shown that they made decisions after this moment about what to say and what not to say based on how badly everything went for the Chicks. And it honestly, it seems like the course of artists, you know, speaking out or not speaking out about politics didn't really reverse until Trump was elected. And then basically, I mean, it still hasn't really reversed in many ways. So that's that inflection point. Anything to add or share?
I think this is great. And I think that your point about it not being inevitable. Well, first of all, they could have just said nothing and had an easy ride. And so this shows that they are, you know, those two sentences that Natalie said very publicly and never took back and doubled down on.
Yes.
When people were like, aren't you sure you want to take this back? She's like, no. Shows that they are a punk band in spirit, and that's beautiful. And also your point that it wasn't inevitable for them to make an amazing, amazing album in response. Because it's much easier to shut down when you're I've never been attacked like that, or most public figures haven't even really. So it seems much easier to shut down, but they clearly had sort of like the fuel of their conviction. And I do know what that feels like. And I think we all do with things that we've done or made or thought. And you can really feel that in that album. And so I just think that's something I'm grateful for and appreciative of all these years later.
Me too. We don't take it for granted. Love it. Okay. So we've done category one albums, category two global events. Let's go into category three.
Okay, category three. So here's the deal. Sometimes it feels obvious and inevitable that someone will be a star. Like Justin Timberlake from NSYNC, who we used to love and now hate. And Beyonce from Destiny's Child, who we used to love and still love. But sometimes we get surprises, and breaking up a band is one of those. And it's so chaotic and truly impossible to predict. So we're going to do one example from this category, and that is bands breaking up.
Yes. So this might not be what you're thinking. We are, in fact, not talking about Harry first. We will be talking about Beyonce going solo after Destiny's Child. So what happened? What's interesting about Beyonce and Destiny's Child is that they kind of broke up twice, as all good relationships do. In 2001, Destiny's Child announced they would pursue solo careers. In 2003, Beyonce released Dangerously in Love. Obviously, Beyonce went on to be arguably the biggest solo artist of our time and launched her career during this in-between time. But we also want to make sure we have context. Both Kelly Rowland and not Michelle Williams, nominated for The Fabelmans, but a different Michelle Williams.
Not Dawson's Creek, Michelle Williams.
did release solo records in 2002. It wasn't just Beyonce, okay? Then in 2005, Destiny's Child released Destiny Filled. After that, they announced they were breaking up, and Beyonce released B-Day in 2007. Kelly and Michelle have gone on to be relatively successful. Kelly has had some great hits, most notably in 2011's iconic sexy dance song Motivation. Kelly has put out four solo albums, and Michelle has just put out three. They haven't completely fallen into obscurity by any means, but of course, Beyonce just looms so large. So some things I felt inevitable about this moment. Beyonce's solo career, and that it would be so successful. She just had that star power immediately and was so clearly at the standard of the group. And I think also Jay-Z and her relationship with him also, one could argue, also elevated her to a lot of success too, with Bonnie and Clyde from 2003. Some things that simply weren't inevitable because actually nothing is. Kelly and Michelle coming out with albums before Beyonce did. Beyonce waiting nearly 2 years after they broke up for the first time to release hers. Beyonce's first solo record being a feature on Jay-Z's song 03, Bonnie and Clyde, rather than her first record being a song with just her, which is something I mentioned earlier. And Beyonce being in two movies before ever releasing an album. How could one forget her incredible starring role in Austin Powers? And in The Fighting Temptations, she's a woman about town. she, you know, it was 20 years ago, as one does, they not only sing, but they act too. And she, beautiful now, beautiful then. Mm-hmm. And the biggest one, the Destiny's Child, would come back in 2004. Does that feel as a surprise to you too?
Yes. I feel like I had honestly forgotten that they like actually broke up in 2001, because that feels so early. Like, I feel like 2001 feels to me in my head, my brain timeline, like the height of Destiny's Child, but no, they were broken up and then they got back together. And I remember Destiny Fulfilled. That was a great album. I asked for it for Hanukkah and I got it. And so I really associate it with like winter of, I guess that was like 05, 06. And then they broke up again, which is just interesting. I mean, it seems like that was kind of always the plan. It doesn't seem like they changed their mind. It seems like that was kind of the plan. But yeah, I just think that's very rare for that to happen to a band in that kind of specific way.
Yeah, I wonder when things like that, it's like, was there a contract they forgot about? Was a producer like, hey, you got to do this? Like, was there like something that they were that they like were obligated to do?
Yeah. And I think, so I would still say that I think at least part of 2001 was still the height, because yes, they still had singles that year, and very, yes, they were coming off of the truly Y2K music video theme of like looking like you're dancing inside of a spaceship or a computer, yes, hard drive. You know what I mean? But that was still going on then. I don't remember feeling that surprised, because I a lot of groups were breaking up around that time. I am surprised actually a little bit that 2001 was the end. I agree. I feel like it was maybe like a little bit later, but that's not true. I do feel like, you know, when NSYNC announced that they were going on hiatus, they were kind of like, but we might be back and stuff. And there didn't seem to be, that we knew of, a huge like interpersonal reason why Destiny's Child broke up. So when they got back together, I was like, oh, okay, cool. But then when they did get back together, it felt very, very quickly that like this was the last hurrah, really. And I mean, Destiny Fulfilled is sounds very final, but also just some of their songs, which I did like. But I think Cater to You was one where I was like, wait, what? Like, it was a jam, but it was also like
the opposite of Bills, Bills, Bills.
Or an Independent Woman.
Independent Woman,
one,
I mean.
And,
yeah.
And Bills, Bills, Bills.
Yeah.
And Bugaboo, and, you know, a bunch of songs, which is fine. But I was like, I don't know where we go from here. And it does seem like Destiny is fulfilled. And so maybe we're done now. So yeah, I did absolutely forget that Michelle and Kelly released albums first.
Yeah, me too.
Mm.
Totally, totally, until we were putting this timeline together.
Mm-hmm.
So what does this tell us? Well, I think when bands break up, it feels like anything can happen. When you look back, it feels inevitable that Beyonce would be the biggest star, but we know that nothing is. She really was focused on everything: music, fashion, perfume, acting, la-di-da. She was launching a brand. Now she represents, in a way, the ultimate artist who can meld pop and popular music with cutting edge art. Her commitment to music and celebrity as art was not immediately apparent. There were crumbs of it all throughout her early work, but it wasn't until her album 4, and maybe even her 2013 self-titled album Beyonce, that who she is today really came into focus. Sometimes you really do need to break free in order to fulfill your own destiny. Gorgeous. Wow. Tears are in my eyes.
Wow. Becky's like, tears are in my eyes from the thing that I just said.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. And as you know, we are breaking up, so be prepared.
Be prepared. So I have to say, in getting ready for this episode, I watched an interview that Beyonce did on the Letterman show about Destiny's Child breaking up. And it wasn't like the cringiest thing I've ever seen in terms of interviews, but it really made me understand why she just is like never going to do an interview again. Like, interviews are brutal. They're just brutal. And especially back in the day when she was just doing them, like, I don't know. I don't think that you know, the hosts these days are so much better, but it was just really, it was like a little uncomfortable to watch. But one of the things, you know, he like, she comes in and he's like, oh, you smell so good. And she's like, thank you. It's my new perfume. Like she, and it just reminded me of how much she really was hustling at this point to build her brand as just literally anything celebrity. And I just so associate her as a music artist right now. I know she has Ivy Park. I know she also like, you know, produces new talent like Chloe and Halle, but I don't know. I don't associate her with perfume. I don't associate her with acting anymore. Although she, you know, she's done a number of things. Dreamgirls came not so far after, and she was amazing in that. But yeah, and I don't know. It was just like really reminding me of how like we feel like her career is inevitable, but she, you know, if she were to do an interview with the B-sides, for example, I bet she would tell us that like none of her stardom feels inevitable to her, that like she saw every counterfactual at every point of how like she could have just been a part of a 90s girl group that like when that kind of style faded, she was gone too. And now like she's one of the biggest stars in the world. And I think she really like made that happen for herself.
Hannah, what artists do you associate with their perfume? Just a question. You made that such a definitive statement. You're like, so Beyonce, funny. I never think about perfume. And I'm like, what artist are you like?
I kind of think about Ariana Grande's perfume.
I knew that's what you're going to say. You think about Ariana Grande.
No, I mean, like I remember that Taylor Swift had her perfumes, although she doesn't anymore. You're right. I don't have a lot.
And there was a time, I mean, this was a different time, but Britney used to have like iconic perfume commercials. And so it's, I agree. It's not like the number one thing. Hopefully if they're doing a good job as a music artist, but like it is something.
And I don't even associate her with like her sub brands, I guess is also what I mean. I just don't. Even with Ivy Park.
Yeah. I think another thing that's interesting about this is that Beyonce absolutely could have gone off and had a solo career that involved her being a much more approachable celebrity who still does interviews and goes on Instagram Live and is a huge star, but like takes fan questions, and she could have done all of that and still been very successful. But since the album Beyonce, she really, and like you said, starting with Four, like there were signs of it. She's really gone into this deity direction where she beams down to give us some art. She never does interviews. We miss her. We miss her interviews, but we get it. Interviews are horrible and I don't enjoy them either. But she didn't have to do that. And she is doing it at a time when it's in some ways harder to do that than ever, because so like there was a time when more celebrities were like that because we didn't have access to them all the time and we didn't have social media and we just had award shows and magazines and like these big interviews and things like that. And she's doing it at a time when so many people are showing us like more of their lives, or at least, you know, what they want us to see all the time, giving us content at all hours. And I just think that's very, very interesting.
And by the way, Beyonce, if you're listening, we are curious about the Renaissance visuals. No pressure, just like we're curious about them. We're just curious. At the time of this recording, we do not have them. See, she can do whatever she wants. She doesn't have to release music videos.
Yeah.
She's totally at another level. Mm-hmm. And we wish Kelly and Michelle the best.
Always.
Always.
I love Michelle. I just had to say Michelle's bridges.
Oh,
just a moment for Michelle's bridges and a lot of these songs. Incredible.
I definitely have like an early pop music analysis memory for myself of like listening to Destiny Fulfilled and feeling like, could there have been even one song where she'd sing a verse? Like even just one. Like I remember thinking it was genuinely fascinating. Like they're not even like pretending. She only sings bridges, and every bridge is sung by her. I had a hard time saying that sentence, but you understand what I'm saying.
Yes. Okay. One more follow-up question and then we will move on. The video of them walking out on stage where she falls and Beyonce and Kelly just like look at her with disdain. Did that clarify anything for you or not really?
I mean, I guess, yeah, right?
Yeah.
But they also, they do have, like, if they hate each other, they're much better at hiding it than other bands. Really good at hiding it. Really good.
Yep.
Don't you think?
Yeah. Yeah. And I would guess that they do not hate each other at this point, but who knows for sure. I agree though. If they do, they're great at hiding it, except for that one moment.
I'll link that video in the show notes.
No, don't give it more views.
Don't? You don't think I should?
No, you can. Whatever.
Everybody click it, but click it once. Just once.
Just once.
Okay, so as we're wrapping up this category of bands breaking up and artists going solo, here are just three others that we wanted to share in this category. The first is NSYNC. Each of those members have their own inflection point. That's not true. Not all of them have an inflection point from this. Some don't. One thing that's interesting is like the non-stardom of JC Chazet. I feel like he actually was set up for somewhat of success. Like he is very talented. I think he could have had a really interesting career and he just didn't. So that bummer for him. I hope he's fine.
Yeah. That first song that he came out with, everyone was just like, oh,
what was
no.
it? Like ladies kissing each other. What was it called?
I remember that. I forget what it was called.
Was it about ladies?
Because it's, and I think it's annoying to be like, what was it called while we have the internet at our disposal? I can't spell his name. That's good.
Oh, it took me like six tries.
Okay. Blowing Me Up With Her Love. I think that was it.
Oh, wait. Is there a ladies kissing ladies song? Or
I have no idea. Why was his debut studio album called Schizophrenic? That's kind of fucked up. That's, I mean, 2002. Hello. You know.
What? Okay. We were going to do this rapid fire. We still will. But I'm like, what?
Oh.
You're trying to launch a brand for yourself after breaking up from your band. You shouldn't have an album that's like, first of all, Schizophrenic is ableist, but second of all, it's like makes it impossible to know who you are because the whole point is that you're a bunch of different things. And it's like, how about you just tell us who you are because we're trying to figure out who you are in this post breakup. Like,
now you have the chance. Yeah. I think maybe the follow-up single, which came out in 2004, that's kind of later, is that you're thinking of is Some Girls in parentheses Dance with Women. Is it that?
How do you remember that?
I don't. I literally looked it up because I was like, it's
Hannah,
to be...
but she knew.
Oh, like, okay. Well, she didn't.
We're pop I don't know music historians, you guys. That's their jobs.
You're like, I have different words in my head, but the concept is there.
I remember thinking it was like off. I wasn't super like, you know, woke about sexuality and in culture, but I remember thinking like, who are you?
Mm-hmm.
Sing this song.
Well, I'm just reading about how this song's lack of success has been attributed to the content, which is seen as fetishizing bisexuality for the male gaze. So I think you were onto something in 2004.
I mean, or I read an article about it in 2014, for example, and you know, forgot when that opinion first latched into my brain.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, JC. Another one in this category is Fifth Harmony. I think it's interesting that Camila Cabello, she's no Beyonce, but she like, you know, she's still making music. She's certainly a celebrity. She's like, you know, doing more than, you know, the lovely Ali Brooke, for example, another Fifth Harmony member. So I think the continued staying power of her is interesting. And I think as we always talk about, the not quite stardom of Normani is also fascinating. Go to episode 50 if you want to hear us like really talk about Normani again and again. And then of course, the other in this category that could have been not only a whole bullet point in this section, but a whole episode in itself is One Direction. Unlike NSYNC and unlike Fifth Harmony, each of those boys actually has like that moment being an inflection point and what happened after for them. I think Zayn's immediate rise to fame and then followed by an immediate fall is very fascinating. Harry's stardom, of course, is fascinating. Niall's surprisingly amazing singer-songwriter career that now landed him with like a Vogue Beauty Secrets video this week. And like, he's a voice coach, like, you know, he's killing it out there. So all of that. Yeah, there's a lot of inflection points when a band breaks up, the constellations of what can happen from there.
you know, are there's a lot there.
Mm-hmm. All right. And the Backstreet Boys just continue to go on hiatuses occasionally, but come back together.
Yeah. But they don't have, they've never come out with a new album, right? They just like are riding high off their old stuff.
They did. I don't think they've come out with one recently, but they have come out with new ones that just, I think, aren't good or just aren't the moment anymore. You know?
Got it.
Sure. Okay. So our final category, category four, this is a category four inflection point. Okay.
Storm.
Yeah. Rapid fire catch all for other inflection points we didn't put in another category and that we aren't going to go into in depth in this episode. So thanks to some of you for suggesting some of these on Instagram. Okay, ready?
Go.
Here we go. When Taylor Swift lost the Album of the Year Grammy for Red in 2014.
The Jonas Brothers 2019 reunion, also Nick and Priyanka's wedding.
Rihanna's song Umbrella. Enough said. Inflection point.
The bombing at the Ariana Grande concert and basically everything that happened to Ariana in 2017 to 2018 was an individual inflection point.
Yeah, I guess we're getting serious here. Demi Lovato's 2018 overdose.
Yeah, it's funny to be like Rihanna Umbrella and also bombing and overdoses. Pop music is complex, man. It's a
hard, hard pivot. Yep. Hard pivot in tone. Okay.
I would say this one is a little less serious, but still serious. This is from Emily on Instagram, a reminder. Justin Timberlake and Janet Jackson's Super Bowl halftime show. Total inflection point for both of their careers, mostly Janet's.
Mm-hmm. From Hadley, the rise of Jack Antonoff and him becoming ubiquitous in pop music writing.
Agreed. From Emma, Casey Musgraves blowing up with Golden Hour and the divorce from the divorce album being meh. So true.
Mm-hmm.
And then from Jasmine, who, by the way, is known on Instagram as Black Bubblegum Pod, who's it's a great account. So give Jasmine a follow. She had two ideas for us. Michael Jackson's 1993 trial. And also when Kanye's mom, Donda, died. Total inflection points. So what are our takeaways from this episode? Mimi, Becky, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I think my takeaway is that inflection points are good things.
Yeah.
For artists. I think they're necessarily, I think at least the ones that you focused on are, they're good things that they like help rebuild an image or sometimes it's take a stand, but none of them, end up hurting the person.
Yeah. They're good as long as they aren't something that kills you, basically.
As Kelly Clarkson says,
she does. Direct quote. Yeah, I think all of these just kind of reiterate how much is up in the air. And for me, it reaffirms the things that I want to tear down. And it makes me grateful for all of the good stuff in my life and in the world of the wide world of pop culture, you know?
Totally.
Yeah. Hannah, did you have any takeaways or any additional thoughts from putting together this episode?
Yeah, I think that I do think that like when we are consuming culture, when we're consuming music news or music itself, it, you know, there are a lot of moments that feel like a big deal, but then they get kind of like slotted into a very linear timeline in our brains. And it's just so helpful to take these moments and be like, okay, wait, like, what are the counterfactuals of every one of these moments? Like nothing had to be the way that it is. And I think it's just really useful to remember that. And I think, yeah, there's just a lot of before and after moments in pop culture, like more than we really realize. And maybe honestly, you can get like really big and just say that every single moment is there's a before and an after from that moment. I mean, yeah, I think that you never really know what's going to happen. But when you look back, everything feels like it slots into a narrative that makes sense because that's like how our brains need to be able to process an overall story. But especially when you're like witnessing something unfold in real time, it's like useful and fun to think to yourself like, oh, like what's a different way this could be going here? And then always as we talk about like what is the role of the consumer we didn't talk about that a lot. I mean, we kind of did, especially in the Mariah example. But you know, it's good for us to be like smart consumers of music and music news and like, you know, be a part of shaping history or just shaping the way that, you know, a story is being told as it's unfolding about an artist in real time.
Love it. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger, I guess. And a moment like this.
Moment like this.
Every inflection point.
Inflection point. First American Idol winner, please.
Yeah.
Oh, amazing. All right. So that's our show. But of course, it's not the end of this conversation. We can't wait to hear what you think. Let us know on Instagram. Let us know on Discord. Send us an email, whatever you want. And if you have a second and you want to support us, please leave us a review on iTunes or on your podcast app of choice. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the B-Sides podcast. We want to connect with you.
Check out the show notes to find our Instagram, Twitter, and join our Discord, where you can link up with us and other progressives who love pop.
Please take a minute to subscribe, rate, and review if you haven't already, and consider supporting the B-Sides on Patreon. Until the next time we cut to the feeling, I'm Mimi.
I'm Becky.
I'm Hannah.